Good morning, everyone. Yes. It's a bit more intimate in here. Yes, we have less people, but that just means it's gonna be a little bit more concentrated. That's exciting. So good morning. We're a hair early. We're scheduled to start around 9, maybe a little bit before. So you still have some time. Please enjoy some breakfast items. But we're here at the last day of the conference. Yay, applause, yay, we love it. It's been great so far hearing all of the wonderful and seeing and learning from all of the wonderful presenters. So I want to thank everyone who's presented up to this point and who will be presenting toward the end of the conference. So just to get you all familiar with what's going to be going on today, I don't anticipate us having to go downstairs for any presentations. We'll just go downstairs to eat. So everything will be either in this room or our small conference room in the rear. So on that note, I want to go ahead and let you know who's speaking because there's been a small change. So in our small conference room will be Rachel Fleming and Megan, I'm so sorry, Megan Grewingholt. Okay. We'll be Megan Grewingholt discussing or titled or equivalent, Rethinking Inclusivity and Experience Barriers in Librarianship. And here in the large room will be Lawrence Maminta and Selena Portera discussing something very, very important and timely. What's your title? Disinformation as Colonial Violence. So we have some awesome selections. So I'm very, very excited. We'll get started in about a couple minutes or so. Thank you. Or you want to get started right now? You can, whatever you like. All right, again, it's vibes in here. Yes, okay, there you go.
One more round of applause for Raheem. It does take a lot of labor, physical, intellectual, and emotional to organize and carry out these conferences. So, you know, Raheem, Shamika, Kelly, Grace, and a bunch of people whose names I don't know made this possible. So just one more round of applause. Thank you all so much. Thank you. I got 8:58. Who's not ready? Oh, great. Okay, let's just jump right into it. My name is Lawrence Maminta. I'm a queer, trans, second-gen, Filipinx immigrant / settler working on occupied Tonga Gabrieleño land at Long Beach City College. Oh, my pronouns are they, them. My bad.
My name is Selena Portera. I am a librarian at Santa Barbara City College. My pronouns are she, her. My maternal family is from the borderlands of Mexico and Texas, and my father's family is indigenous to Quilpan, Michoacan. That's me.
We've seen some land acknowledgments through some of the presentations. We are on occupied Tambien Ohlone land. For sure want to acknowledge them, but I also want to point out that Selena and I stand in solidarity with all of their efforts to reclaim their ancestral homelands. So the title of our presentation is Disinformation as Colonial Violence, Zionist Terror in Print and in the Stacks. Colonialism is nasty business, so we have a content warning up front. We'll be discussing settler violence, racism, infanticide, and sexual violence. You know, if you need to step out, like, no hard feelings, we understand how this content could be triggering for people. We won't take it personal. All right, we're talking about disinformation. So we feel that it is important to be as accurate as we can in our language. We understand Israel to be one of the United States colonial outposts. As such, We won't refer to it as Israel. We'll refer to it as the Zionist occupation or the settler colony of Israel. And since it is an occupation, we don't refer to the military arm of the colony as the IDF. We call it the IOF, or Israeli Occupation Forces. We definitely don't use Israel-Palestine to refer to the area. We use Occupy Palestine or Palestine. We definitely object to the phrase war in Gaza. Also, Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Just looking at Article 2 of the Geneva Conventions, it's a genocide, checks all the boxes. Although we won't say war in Gaza, the reason for that is this definition is from the Oxford English Dictionary, and I highlighted this part here. Carried on between nations, states, or rulers, or between parties in the same nation or state. So there's just inherent in this definition is a sense of symmetry. Those of you who are here for Becca's lightning talk, mentioning asymmetry, I feel is much more descriptive of what's going on over there. Now, just because we're not saying war in Gaza, that doesn't mean we're not centering war in our analysis. Disinformation tactics are considered weapons or weaponized forms of information by the state, the Department of Defense. This is the logo for CISA, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is under the Department of Homeland Security. And what they do is they put out these publications, which you can look up in PDF form. I don't expect you to read all this, but this is the type of information you'll find when you look for how the state looks at disinformation. I don't expect you to read this. I just want us to focus on what are disinformation tactics. Specifically disinformation, and then I highlighted manipulate their audience to a specific end. The audience in reference to this presentation is us, is us here in the global north, and hopefully that becomes much clearer as we go on. This definition of disinformation is from the American Psychological Association. Disinformation is false information which is deliberately intended to mislead, intentionally misstating the facts. And up here, we have the American Library Association, which we'll call ALA from here on out, policy B89 on disinformation, media manipulation, and the destruction of public information. ALA says they oppose the use by government of disinformation, media manipulation, the destruction and excision of public information, and other such tactics. Just a quick reminder, this was initially put forth by the Social Responsibilities Roundtable in 2005 after the second US invasion of Iraq. All right, so let's get into a bit. Zionist disinformation tactics, two specifically, flooding the information environment and manipulating actors. We're gonna focus on two false narratives that have been promoted regarding beheaded babies and mass sexual violence, and mass sexual violence first. No, you're good. November 26, 2023, this is a position paper released by an organization, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, a Zionist organization. I'll read the title, Gender-Based Violence as a Weapon of War During the October 7 Hamas Attacks. Lucy Williamson at the BBC. December 5th, 2023. Israel, Gaza, Hamas raped and mutilated women on 7 October BBC hears. Sam Mednick at the Associated Press. New signs emerge of widespread sexual crimes by Hamas as Netanyahu alleges global indifference. Isaac Chotiner, December 10th, 2023, The New Yorker. How Hamas used sexual violence on October 7th. Physicians for Human Rights Israel issued a report collecting evidence of sexual and gender-based violence. One of its authors lays out their findings. Kathy Pollitt at The Nation, December 15th, 2023. Why have feminists been so slow to condemn the Hamas rapes? Israel's war in Gaza is an atrocity, but we can deplore its action while also condemning the atrocities perpetrated by Hamas. Crowning jewel, New York Times, December 31st, 2023. Screams without words, sexual violence on October 7th. Hamas subjected Israeli women to horrors before killing them, evidence shows. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Jeffrey Gettleman, Anand Schwartz, and Adam Sella. And I'm saying the names and saying the dates because I feel it's important for us to focus on regarding this mass rapes narrative. And we'll move on to the beheaded babies. This is a tweet from Nicole Zedek, who is a reporter for one of the Zionist occupation's media outlets, I-24. You could read the whole tweet, but especially that last half. One of the commanders told me they saw babies' heads cut off. It's an apocalyptic scene, the site of a true massacre. And you'll notice that the post that Nicole Zedek is quote tweeting is unavailable because I-24 News removed the post. Joshua Zitzer and Rebecca Cohen, October 10th, 2023, Business Insider. IDF says Hamas fighters killed and decapitated babies at one kibbutz near the Gaza border. From the same article, one of the bullet points. The IDF told Insider that some have been decapitated. Olivia Land at the New York Post, October 10th, 2023. Hamas kills 40 babies and children, beheading some of them at Israeli kibbutz, report. My favorite source of information, Fox News Channel. Terrorism. At least 40 babies, some beheaded, found by Israel soldiers in Hamas-attacked village. Lawrence Richard, October 10th, 2023. And across the pond, front page of The Independent, Bell True, October 11th, 2023. They decapitated women and children. We saw dead babies, an Israeli major claims. The bodies are hidden, so it's impossible to verify. But this village smells of death. CNN, Lauren Izzo and Mustafa Salem, October 11th, 2023. Babies and toddlers were found with heads decapitated in Kfar Aza, Netanyahu spokesperson says. I-24 News, I carried a beheaded baby in my hands, says kibbutz Berry rescuer. So I hope everyone notices that these are mainstream corporate media outlets that this narrative is being pushed through. So when I said like flooding the information environment, this is how it's executed. And let's get to the actor manipulation.
I never really thought that I would see and have confirmed pictures of terrorists beheading children.
That was October 11th, 2023. This is found on NBC News' website. October 18th, 2023.
Children slaughtered, babies slaughtered, entire families massacred. Rape, beheading, bodies burned alive. Hamas committed atrocities that recall the worst ravages of ISIS, unleashing pure, unadulterated evil upon the world.
So what's going on here, right? These stories are being pushed. We have the president going on national television, repeating these narratives. And there's an affective quality to them, right? There's something that arouses specific emotions in us. And you know, I don't have to theorize because Edward Said clocked this in the late 70s in Orientalism. In the films and television, the Arab is associated either with lechery or bloodthirsty dishonesty. He appears as an oversexed degenerate, capable, it is true, of cleverly devious intrigues, but essentially sadistic, treacherous, low. And we can see how these narratives kind of play on these inherent Western ideas of Arabs. And I also want to talk a little bit about Hasbada. This is from Jura Goodman's Explaining the Occupation, Israeli Hasbada and the Occupied Territories in the Aftermath of the June 1967 War. This article explores the policymaking process behind Israel's immediate post-war propaganda and public diplomacy, or Hasbada in Hebrew, intended to put before foreign audiences the necessity and legitimacy of the occupation. So there's a playbook. This is from the World Union of Jewish Students, titled The Hasbada Handbook, Promoting Israel on Campus. This is from March 20, 2002. And I wanted to point to a specific section in the handbook, which you can find online. Section is called What's in a Word? Consider the difference between describing somebody as a terrorist, freedom fighter, militant, or activist. And this handbook goes into different strategies, specifically rhetorical strategies, to either deflect from what the occupation is doing in Palestine. So let's get back to the narratives. This is from Jake Tapper and Kirsten Appleton, CNN. November 19, 2023. Israel investigates sexual violence committed by Hamas as part of October 7th horror. Despite the headline, they do admit investigators do not have firsthand testimony and it is not clear whether any rape victims survive. Story from The Intercept, Between the Hammer and Anvil, the story behind the New York Times October 7th expose. February 28, 2024, Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Grimm, Daniel Bogoslaw. From the same article, months after setting off on their assignment, the reporters found themselves exactly where they had begun, the reporters being Gettleman, Schwartz, and Sella, relying overwhelmingly on the word of Israeli officials, soldiers, and Zaka workers to substantiate their claim that more than 30 bodies of women and girls were discovered with signs of sexual abuse. From the same article. I guess I should have mentioned that Screams Without Words is focused on a woman named Gal Abdush. And the woman who filmed Abdush on October 7th told the Israeli site Ynet that Schwartz and Sella had pressured her into giving the paper access to her photos and videos for the purposes of serving Israeli propaganda. She says, they called me again and again and explained how important it is to Israeli Hasbada. Yes Magazine, Arun Gupta, March 5th, 2024. Claims of mass rape by Hamas unravel upon investigation. From the same article, the dearth of evidence of mass rapes has been attributed to Israeli government claims that religious concerns and chaos prevented the gathering of forensic evidence. But other reports indicate Israel manipulated evidence, forensics, and Zaka testimony that all create the appearance of a campaign of mass rape. Haaretz reported Zaka volunteers sidelining soldiers and collecting evidence after October 7th. Again, from the same article. The president based his comments about the alleged atrocities on the claims from Netanyahu's spokesman and media reports from Israel, according to the White House. Biden's claims were featured on the front pages of Western newspapers, and reports of beheaded babies have been cited in some quarters as justification for revenge attacks and the collective punishment of civilians in Gaza. From Al Jazeera, White House walks back Biden's claim he saw children beheaded by Hamas. And, you know, there's a lot of great reporting going on, just showing and dismantling these narratives. Yet at the same time, we saw how many major media news outlets picked it up and presented them as fact. And I'm not gonna claim to be an expert in journalism. I never went to journalism school, but if I could insert my opinion that, like, the journalism seems spotty from the jump. And, you know, as Arun Gupta wrote, it was meant to justify whatever violence was visited upon Palestinians after October 7th. But with this same kind of violence is happening to Palestinians, this is from the United Nations Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner. UN experts appalled by reported human rights violations against Palestinian women and girls, 19 February 2024. Didn't see this on NBC, ABC. Definitely didn't see it on Fox News. Or instances of sexual violence committed by IOF soldiers. Here's a picture of IOF soldiers having stripped and bound Palestinian men in Gaza. Here's a picture of them holding up women's underwear. This is a picture from a press conference at Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital, which the Zionist occupation attacked in October, which they denied, by the way, and major media outlets, you know, took the IOF at their word. Although Forensic Architecture, this firm in the UK, did a bunch of evidence showing that the settler colony of Israel did indeed attack Al-Ahli Hospital. From Middle East Monitor, Israel left premature Palestinian babies to die alone after evacuating Gaza Hospital. So when we look at, you know, these instances of sexual violence, infanticide, violence against children committed by the IOF, you know, we won't hear these narratives. I mean, I think the short answer to what's going on here is, you know, racism, right? White hegemony. But if we could take this opportunity to just sharpen our analysis a little bit, it's a form of colonial erasure. It's a way of normalizing the violence committed against Palestinian, normalizing the brutal and oppressive conditions that Palestinians have to live through. And, like, this is all macro level stuff. You're probably wondering, like, look, we're librarians. That's happening way over there. What's this got to do with us? And, you know, hopefully my colleague Selena will be helping illuminate why that is.
Yeah, so what does it have to do with us besides the obvious, you know, misinformation, disinformation in the world? I am new faculty at Santa Barbara City College. Previous to this past school year, I was working as a resident there, and I applied to and was hired as full-time faculty. And I was part of a cluster hire to serve Black and Brown students specifically because the library is very white. We all know that our profession is about 85 to 90% white still, I think, from last time I checked, maybe several months ago. And coming in, one of the things that I've been doing was making book displays. And we have 4 to 5 book displays going on year round. And one of the displays that I have pretty much year round since I was a resident is a book display on colonialism. So I have all kinds of books up there about colonialism, and included in those in that display is books on Palestine, because you can't really do a book display about colonialism without including Palestine, right? So this was before October 7th. So October 7th comes around, students come in, see this book display that has books about Palestine. They get upset, they complain to administration, say that they feel unsafe, that the book display is anti-Semitic because it doesn't have books about the Holocaust. So I complained to admin. Shortly after that, our school started receiving death threats. Can you go to the next slide? So IT actually, our IT department hid the death threats from us, from our emails. They filtered them out so we didn't actually see them right away. And this is an email from IT to one of my colleagues where it says, all Hamas supporters will be wiped from this earth. We will return justice to all that we lost. That was the gist of the email, and obviously it's threatening. We began receiving hundreds of these. They were going mostly to administrators, so I didn't see a lot of them. This one, like I said, was forwarded to me from a colleague. Can you go to the next slide? Okay, and the student had reached out to several deans on campus, and this is a response from one of the deans to the student, letting them know that they were sorry that they felt unsafe because of these books that we had on display about Palestine. This person who wrote this email, who was responding to the student, you know, said that they are a PhD student, or they were a PhD student under Rashid Khalidi. Am I pronouncing that right? Who wrote the 100 Years War on Palestine, and which is also one of the books that the student had complained about. We met with this person who wrote this email, and this person reprimanded the library, reprimanded me, I should say, because I'm the one who did the book display. And, you know, it ties back to being, you know, the insufficient librarian, right? Like, how can you be a sufficient librarian in a system that is blatantly racist, right? And I'm pretty much the only visible person of color in this library, and I am brand new faculty, so it's you know, been rough because there's a lot of microaggressions we all know, you know, that we face in the library. Can be a hostile environment. We don't talk about these things. I think me and Lawrence had a conversation recently. I don't know how it came up, but we were talking about how if you want to get the room to just stay totally quiet or change the subject, just bring up Palestine. And it's an interesting thing because as librarians, you know, this is a big deal. Like, how are we handling this? How do we want to handle it? What do we want our futures to look like? What do we want the futures for our children to look like if we don't talk about these things? And like, what is the harm in talking about it? Like, we can't even say the word Palestine in the library. So, yeah, I think I have one more slide after this. I'd like to refer back to Lorgia Garcia Pena's book, Community is Rebellion. And I chose this quote kind of like, because it's like being the one, I think for her, I think being the one is like the one who talks back, right? The talks that pushes back against administration, pushes back against the status quo, how that can harm your career potentially. Garcia Pena was denied tenure at Harvard because she was constantly speaking out against racism and the way she did it. Well, I mean, there is no correct way to do it, right? People don't like it if you push back against the status quo. That's just how it is. And I think about, you know, being the one, like, I really am the one that's pushing back in my place of work, right? No one else is doing it. I will take the lead and people will, you know, back me up, but it's so exhausting to be the one taking the lead. So, yeah, so all going back to the insufficient librarian, right?
Thanks for sharing. I mean, Selena and I talked, so I have like some details of what happened, but like the way admin essentially threw Selena under the bus, it's not a one-off. I mean, I'm thinking about Black and Arab Harvard students who were doxxed and attacked by Zionists, and you know, Edmund had no response to that over there for supporting Palestine. At Columbia, two former IOF soldiers attacked pro-Palestinian students with skunk, which is a chemical weapon, and Edmund had no response to that. I don't know if any of you have noticed any patterns of state and institutional repression for just mentioning or bringing up Palestine, right? And, you know, I often find myself wondering, like, these institutions that were in these settler institutions, that if they were indeed, like, the highest ideal of themselves, right? If, you know, we were allowed to engage in like real intellectual exchange regarding this topic, you know, if they really believed in intellectual freedom, like, would this still be the case? And this is not, I guess, like, just based on our analysis, this is not a particular surprise, these actions. There is an agenda here, but I guess my question for you, Selena, is like, if you could talk a little bit more about being a new early career librarian and, you know, in this particular historical context and experiencing what's institutional abandonment, what I would refer to.
Yeah, institutional abandonment. Even though I'm an early career librarian, I have a ton of work experience. I am 45 years old, so I come from a background of, I've been in law, I've worked in corporations for a lot of my life before I became a librarian. And it's interesting, I've talked to this about this with people in this academic bubble, and one of the things that comes up for me is how academia is so much more conservative and suffocating than being in corporations. And I think, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with, you know, corporations are more careful because they're, you know, they can get sued at any time, and academia is a much different place. And it is shocking to see that, you know, the things that go on and how conservative it is and being abandoned, you know, by leaders. And like, we always talk about, like, what is the point of having leaders if they're just gonna kind of suppress you, I guess, you know? That it's interesting to see the power dynamics every single day at a college.
So Selena and I were in the same MLIS cohort. We graduated in 2020, and we are not American Library Association members. Yet, you know, I pointed out that ALA does have a policy regarding this behavior, right? But like, Selena and I are not expecting backup from ALA, right? Like, we just, you know, even if we were members, and
I'm still confused as to what ALA actually does.
Yeah, same. And I think, you know, just based on your experience, you know, with these organized Zionist groups sending death threats and, you know, coordinating email campaigns, like, I think there's something to be said how these groups, you know, use tactics and often align with the same reactionary forces that are intent on pulling books and materials by Black people, other people of color, queer people off of the shelves and essentially, you know, keeping them away from library patrons and users. And I don't know, I just, in my experience, it seems like these groups are given the benefit of the doubt when they're clearly demonstrated that they're not our friends, they're not interested in intellectual freedom, they're not interested in engaging in this topic in good faith. And I guess that all goes back to like colonialism, right? Like the coloniality of being where, you know, these irrational responses to these analyses just have to be silenced.
Yeah, just going back to the history of libraries, we know that libraries, we heard from Michael Threats that, you know, libraries were segregated and very racist, and like the inception of libraries as a whole was to assimilate people into white culture. So I'm having a hard time really seeing how so anything has really changed. It just looks different, but I want libraries to be better, and I'm trying, you know, my best. I just take things day by day. You know, I know I'm not gonna have backup from administration or anyone above me, but I'm just gonna just keep doing what I do, I guess, you know, just on my own, yeah. And I have colleagues, I have Lawrence, I have some colleagues at other colleges that can reach out to for support, but not necessarily in my place of work, but it's good to reach out to people.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we have any calls to action or recommendations. I mean, you know, anyone who's interested in meeting or connecting with other librarians doing Palestine solidarity work, for sure, link up with us afterwards. But I guess at this time, we can open the floor for questions, comments, criticisms, yeah.
My name is Miguel Murillo. First, I want to say thank you for bringing this topic. And this is actually something that I've been talking about it a lot, but it's also, I'm also new to my position, and I'm also one of the only person of color in my library as well. And we actually had to deal with, I don't know if anybody else is dealing with this, but we got an ADL pledge that was brought up to Anti-Defamation League. So we got like to our Senate. Basically there was core faculty who wanted us to pledge to basically, let me see if I can pull it up. Give me a moment please, sorry. So basically saying that it's an a Senate resolution request that SDCC Mesa College sign, implement the Anti-Defamation League workplace pledge to fight anti-Semitism. So basically it was bullet points saying that any type of like image, issues, topics, images, books, or anything like that, that basically we have to, that seem anti-Semitic or is anti-Semitic. So that was one of the things that I was kind of like in a weird position because I am new. And I have to worry about tenure. And how much can I actually voice out? And it's kind of hard because also even like the content in the library, like the books are out there, the events that we want to be a part of, the different activities outside of work, and then the actual meeting when I went to see the discussion on it, there was people being recorded. Those who were for and those who were against were the ones who were going against were recorded. And we all know that's not fair, and that's also intimidation, but nobody talked about that. And again, yeah, so when we talk about diversity and inclusion and a safe space, how are we showing that in our institutions? When we need to step up, it's not happening. And that's one of the things I was pointing out, but it's kind of hard to be vocal when you're new, and the people who are in a position of power are the ones who are gonna be doing your evaluation.
And then also it goes back to, you know, people who have tenure and say they, you know, oh, I'll fight back or I'll be loud when I have tenure because I, you know, have a guaranteed position, but that never really happens that I've seen. And with me, I'm in the same position, right? It takes probably 5 years to get tenure in my place of work. And, you know, when I say things, when I push back, I get thanked by people who don't say anything. And they're the ones who have tenure, right? And I'm here like, okay, like, why am I the only one saying anything? It's difficult, yeah.
I was just wondering, I was trying to write down something you said that really struck me as something relevant in my institution. You said, what is the point of having leaders if they're not going to? And then I'm not sure what you said after that, but I wanted to write it down.
I think I may have said if they're not going to help or back us up. Like I said, when an admin came to us and reprimanded at the library for not having opposing viewpoints, I guess, on my colonialism book display, instead of, you know, this person basically told us that we needed to have more information, that we needed to do better about book displays, and like kind of like made stuff up about how to do book displays. This person's not a librarian, is not, you know, doesn't oversee the library at all. So it was really strange. And it's kind of like that she was basically just working to kind of suppress us in a way and doing the opposite, I think, of what a leader should do. I think that's what I was trying to get at earlier.
Hi, thank you so much. You've given me a lot to think about, and that's always good for practice. I was at a conference, we were there together. What was that conference? We were at the POC Enlist conference. Were either of you there?
Yeah, we presented there, yeah.
Okay, I wonder if it's the same presentation. But now I'm feeling very foolish.
It was different. It was a different presentation.
Well, I heard somebody talking about like leaders as actually like. It was you. Okay, I'm gonna be quiet now. Maybe you want to share with the rest of us what you were sharing, because this is exactly what it feels like. I don't really trust administrators to do anything in response to power. I think that they, you know, you speak. I'll be quiet.
Yeah, we did. Selena and I, along with one of our comrades, Luz Padillo, just to quickly sum up, did a presentation at POC and LIS about, ultimately about racialized non-white people in positions of power, administrators, deans, etc., and how they're not incentivized to act that different from toxic white people. Some of my best friends are toxic white people, so I can say that. But there are ways of disciplining people into behaving in certain ways that are harmful ultimately to workers, because at the source they are colonial corporate structures. That's the elevator pitch, I guess. Right. Any other comments, critiques, clapbacks? Conundrums, congratulations, commands, caterwauling.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, or I don't know if you're familiar with the group Librarians with Palestine. So if that's a resource for some people that are not aware, that's one way. And I also wanted to thank you for this conversation. I think I've been a student for a very, very long time, and it's just now that I'm on the job market. And as a student, I was always kind of the one and pushing back, and at certain job in workspaces as well, I was even thanked by faculty themselves, just the same way, like after I spoke up in meetings, and then faculty came in, one faculty member came in and thanked me for speaking up, but I'm like, I'm a student. Like, they should have spoken up, or at least backed me up in that moment of speaking up against an issue with white male professors. But, oh my gosh, I'm forgetting my point. But yeah, so it was easier for me to like speak up as a student because I think that's encouraged, right? But once you're a professional or you're on the job market, it's completely different, right? Because I mentioned, I think of tenure, I think of hiring and all of that. And so I think Palestine has really been that that topic for me that has challenged me, that has really like, you know, I realized like, oh, maybe I'm not as brave as I thought I was. I mean, I still think I'm brave, but it really has challenged that, where it's like I didn't speak up about it at my two former jobs, and my former job that I just quit in February. It was in the title, it's a Civil Rights Institute, right? And we didn't speak about it for a very long time at all. And it was a nonprofit, and it was I was the only full-time worker besides the director. And, you know, the director's talking about how we need to have committees. I'm like, committees of what, of who? It's a nonprofit, you know, and it's only me and you and the board. Like, what? All this, I don't know, sorry, I'm like babbling. But anyway, again, I just want to say thank you for this. And yeah, Palestine's that one topic that really, I think has really challenged us a lot as a profession, as academics, intellectuals, and people. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Just a quick reminder about the profession does have professional values and ethical values regarding misinformation and disinformation. And, you know, at least from our experience, we have not heard one peep from ALA, ACRL. Honestly, any professional LIS orgs. And again, you know, we're new to the field. We just may not have seen it. Librarians and Archivists for Palestine, which is not like a professional group, it's more of a grassroots collective, obviously vocal. Library Freedom Project, an organization we're a part of, has put out statements. But, you know, that's it, as far as we know. So thank you, Blanca. And Blanca is brave, like, don't let her fool you. She's not one to mess with.
Hi, everybody. I'm Nettie. I just wanted to thank you for your really powerful presentation. It was very touching. What I've seen, the way that I've seen folks approach this issue is like by, you know, creating libguides or maybe book displays showing both sides of the issue. And that's the only way that I've seen it being approached so far. Considering that it's Arab American Heritage Month, I'm not seeing as many displays as we should be seeing. And I just kind of wanted to pick your brain or like hear about your strategies towards intervening with that sense of neutrality, right? Because neutrality is violence. Showing both sides of the coin to me is not really digging into this kind of perspective of decolonizing, right? And being very transparent. about where you stand with this issue. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm blabbering now, but I was just wondering, like, how do you approach that? Like, I've only seen it in that way. And that was the issue with your book display. It didn't show both sides, or it didn't show enough of the, yeah, Jewish American perspective or something. So yeah, do you have any thoughts about that?
I feel like I try my best not to approach anything with neutrality. The book display that I had up, like I said, it was about colonialism, right? And the way we were reprimanded was like, you need to show both sides. And I pushed back. I said, there is no both sides. It's just colonialism. What other side should I display, you know? And for a couple of days, we did add books about the Holocaust, but I didn't feel, I think just to like appease everyone, because it was kind of like a chaotic time, you know, with the death threats. And people were coming in and taking pictures of the books on Palestine. I think, I don't even know if they were students. I think it was community members that got wind of it, and they were upset. I'm not sure if any students were even involved in all that stuff. So yeah, I did appease them for a couple of days because I just wanted people off my back. But then I ended up not feeling right about that, so I removed the books, and it went back to the way it was before, and it was fine. And I do want to point out too that a couple of the books were stolen from the display, the Palestine ones. They were removed by whoever, maybe, I'm just theorizing here, probably the people that were upset. The books just went missing, so that happened too.
Thank you so much, Lawrence. Thank you, both of you, for the courage to give this presentation. I am going to speak from a different point of view, and that is when we see pictures or the news about people dying during the war, especially children, it kind of seems far away from us because it didn't happen to us. It's like somebody dying. If you hear that somebody died, unless that person is closely related to you, that's when you feel the pain. I am speaking from experience here. I was a child during the Nigeria-Biafra Civil War. And I'm a heavy sleeper. I can sleep through earthquakes. I can sleep even if this building is falling down. If I'm asleep, I'm asleep. So I do thank my mom and my sister for me being alive and being here today. Because sometimes when the enemies come with bombing everywhere, it's my mom that will actually, or my sister that will actually hold my hand. I was a child and I was walking. So I sleep, walk all through for a few miles before I would wake up. It was terrifying. You have young girls, women, like my sister, from throughout the war when she was with us, she had to put a pillow in her, pretend as if she was pregnant because she doesn't know because of the soldiers or what they would do. We have all our brothers and of course the sons and all the young men off, you know, to serve in the military. So there were practically no men around us except older men or men who are really sick or those who were brought back from the war. I kind of shut down from talking about this, and this is actually my first time actually talking about it. It took me a while to write about it. When I was, you know, kept asking, you were a child during the war, can you write? I did write about it, and I don't know, I would say that people kind of picked up on my writing. So I appreciate your sharing the story with us, and also to know that war in any way, whoever is right, there's no right or wrong. You know, until you live through it, it feels so far away. You know, it's like when we hear that a black child is killed, it feels so far away from us because it's not us, it's not our child that was killed. But when it's your child, when it's your brother, when it's that child is related to you, your sister, you know, then you feel the impact. So I do understand what you're saying. I probably won't be too active in helping out because it's a part of my life that I'm still struggling to deal with. So speaking on it or being too active, I can probably do much, but not too much. You know, writing about it, I can. It took me a while to do that, but I did. It's not a very pleasant, experience at all. I was reading the news the other day, and about 20-something or so children who were airlifted out of Biafra because of starvation, or they lost their parents, that's still lost till today. You know, so we don't know where those children are. We don't know what happened to them. You know, so it's like, and the families, some of them are dead. The older ones, you know, their parents are probably dead, so they don't even know how to find their way back home. Probably went off in the wrong direction, but I just wanted to shed more light on the part about the children dying. Thank you.
I'm gonna make my way up to the front. Just have, I think, 5 minutes or so. And I know that we have a comment right here, but I wanna do something that I wasn't planning on doing, which is talking, because as president, running the events and so on and so forth. There is a feeling that I should be neutral and that I should leave the presenters to speak on their things. I'm not gonna do that, I'm gonna deviate because I think that I'm in exactly the right position to do that sort of thing. So I'm just gonna take a second and then I'm gonna go up to our friend up here who has an additional comment. But it is exactly that. So when we're talking about these things, and it's deeply personal and so on and so forth, I think it's important to remember that the violence that we're talking about is really top down. We're talking about state entities creating environments of terror. In this instance, one very powerful state entity backed by another extraordinarily powerful state entity, us, the United States, creating an environment of hostility for an occupied people. And that distills down. As a Black person, that's deeply part of my history here in the United States and part of my diasporal history throughout the world. Living as a person who is caught in the middle in many ways, right? As a Black person living in the United States, North America, a territory that is taken, land that is taken from people who already lived here, right? Where we have people doing land acknowledgements, which are great, but you can't give the land back, right? We have to realize that we are individuals trying to contend with the damage that state powers have done. And so our response is always going to be insufficient. But we do the best we can. I don't know if any of y'all are TV watchers, but one of my favorite shows, I'm gonna date myself just a little bit, and you know, hashtag problematic creator, Joss Whedon's show Angel. Deeply impactful for my formative youth, right? But one thing taken away from there is the story of redemption and the idea that if nothing in the world matters, then all that matters is what you do, right? So it is incumbent upon us as individuals who are largely unable to change what state actors do, largely unable to change the tides of war or battle or oppression and so on and so forth. The individual things that we do, like those book displays, the individual things that we do, like standing up to power as students, the individual things that we do, like acknowledging that our Palestinian students and supporters of freeing our Palestine, the way that we support them, if not, you know, with our bodies, then in our actions. If we see them out there, buy them some water, buy a case of water and roll it on out there. You don't even have to stay, right? One thing that we're doing, anything that we can do just to show, because we all have to eat. Nobody, I'm not telling anybody to put themselves out and, you know, end up homeless or end up without a paycheck. But there are things that we can do, and we should always be considering, how can I show up in this moment completely unable to change, completely insufficient in my knowledge, just based on what I'm able to do in the moment, how can I use what I have to do something? That's it. Now I'm gonna come up to my friend here.
Sorry, I just wanted to say some couple of things to what I was saying. Number one, academia wasn't really built for us. So that's my number one, right? Kind of one of the colonial processes. It was like a means to keep people out in certain like echelon. So it's kind of hard to, what I used to always say is I'm there to decolonize the space. It's a lot of work, but just being there is a revolutionary act, number one. Number two is, yeah, being the one, it's kind of hard because it's additional stress and burnout. So I know that, but that's something that I learned that I just got to deal with because as many of my other colleagues just talked about, I get the praises afterwards or in emails or in text messages or like, oh, thank you for saying that. But I'm like, that's cool and all, but I really need your support in the room. And there's other things that you can do. Like for example, something that we did do is that we at the same time that was been pushed, we also put the calling for SDCC to reform the commitment to protection of freedom of speech. So in the same light, we started talking about during Indigenous History Month of like how we need to protect the freedom of speech to talk about colonialism and call things out the way they are. So in the same light that this is being proposed, the other thing was proposed at the same time. So I think that's ways that we can also combat that is by making it seem like, okay, so if this one topic, then it's also gonna be a slippery slope. So we need to protect freedom of speech as well. So that's why I was thinking about like ways in which we can kind of interject those type of roles is by doing the same. It's like, okay, you're gonna talk about this, then we're gonna make sure that we protect it on this side. Because I think we do feel like there's not much we can do, but even if it's minimal, even if it's small, we gotta try. At least that's how I feel. So that's all I wanna say. So thank you so much again for everything.
All right, well, listen, thanks everyone for attending. It's a heavy topic. Usually around this time on Saturday mornings, I'm watching cartoons or playing Persona 5. So we both really appreciate all of you coming to watch and listen. I'll close with Free Palestine.
Yeah, thank you everyone. Definitely hard to get here on a Saturday morning. I used to live here in the Bay, so I've been hanging out with friends, so it was definitely hard to get here this morning.